And we do not want the United Nations to begin in the name of our dear people.
14 Yemeni oil ships remain at the Saudi-led coalition's detention illegally. The vessels were inspected and authorized by the United Nations through verification and inspection mechanism. The detention has led the country to a harsh shortage of fuel.
Yemenis say instead of raising funds for its organization's expenses, the UN must pressure Saudi Arabia to release the detained oil vessels if it wants to help the humanitarian situation. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Italy, disgruntled by the delay of vaccine supplies to Rome and general vaccine shortages in the EU, has called for a shipment to Australia to be blocked. By doing so, it is activating for the first time an export control system instituted by the bloc to make sure companies like the Anglo-Swedish drug maker AstraZeneca honour their contracts. Australia says its vaccine rollout will not be affected by the ban.
They are in an unbridled crisis situation. That is not the situation in Australia. But nevertheless, we've been able to secure our supplies and additional supplies for importation both with Pfizer and AstraZeneca, which means we can continue the rollout of our program.
Out of 450 million Europeans, only 11 million have had a COVID-19 jab. Tired of waiting, countries like Denmark, Austria, Poland, Slovakia and the Czech Republic have given up on Brussels and turned to other suppliers. This week, Hungary received its first shipment of Russia's Sputnik V vaccine as another surge of the virus races across the country.
By next week, Hungary will be the most vaccinated country within the European Union. But even this pace is not fast enough to prevent the spread of the virus and especially its new variants.
The EU is only using Western-approved vaccines at the moment. Europe's drug regulator has launched a review of Russia's Sputnik V, which has an efficacy of 91.6%, insisting geopolitics is not affecting decision-making.
I would like to say very clearly, EMA undertakes its analysis of a vaccine based on health-related criteria related to the safety and the efficacy of the vaccine. Full stop. There is no other consideration than that. And therefore, geopolitics have nothing to do with the fact that you consider that EMA would consider a vaccine safe and efficacious or not. It's based on the assessment of the vaccine.
Russia says it is ready to provide jabs for 50 million Europeans the moment it gets the green light. Vaccine rollouts will only work if they happen fast and evenly across continents, outsmarting mutations. Amid a surge of cases across the whole of Europe, the EU has launched a continent-wide project to strip out supply bottlenecks and boost production, hoping to redeem itself and stave off a third wave. Bianca Rahimi, London.
A sigh of relief for the Pakistani Prime Minister. The country's National Assembly reposed trust in Prime Minister Imran Khan in a vote of confidence. Prime Minister Khan himself sought the vote of confidence from the National Assembly after the government-backed candidate lost to an opposition leader in a Senate election. The defeat of the country's finance minister had raised questions whether the government commanded majority of the parliament. After winning the vote of confidence, Prime Minister Khan made it clear that he would not give any relief to opposition leaders facing corruption cases.
Mr. Zardari has been proven corrupt. He is known as Mr. 10%. On the other hand, Nawaz Sharif, after plundering the national wealth, has fled abroad. I will not give them any amnesty, come what may.
While inside the parliament, members were congratulating the Prime Minister, outside, government and opposition members were clashing with each other. The ruling party workers attacked the senior opposition leaders when they were holding press conference. Opposition parties condemned the violence. But Prime Minister Khan's supporters were jubilant for his success.
These people have not come here on Prime Minister Imran Khan's call. He has not given any official call. These are people who came here spontaneously. We decided ourselves. It's a grassroots movement. We decided that we'll come here to show our support for Imran Khan.
While Khan's supporters defend his performance, opposition thinks the country's economic situation has deteriorated under the current government. Prime Minister Imran Khan may have won the vote of confidence from the parliament, but observers believe his trouble is far from over. Amid economic and other challenges, major opposition parties are planning to march towards the capital later this month to seek his ouster. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
Voices of Divinity. These ear-soothing voices narrate divine verses from the Holy Book of Quran. The recitations come as part of the 37th International Quran Competition based in Iran. 57 finalists from 26 countries are competing in the annual contest, which was held online this year due to the pandemic.
This year, the contestants send us recordings of their recitations. Those recitations then are broadcast live on the IRIB Quran channel, and the judgment is carried out by our selected jury members at the same time. This is a brand new style in holding the competition. All other similar Quranic events are cancelled as a result of the pandemic.
411 participants from 67 countries took part in the primary stage of the competition. 122 contestants made it to the semi-final stage. Participants compete in three different fields of recitation, memorization, and interpretation.
Listening to the verses of the Quran through the beautiful voice of Quran reciters gives you better peace and spirituality. Such recitations permeate the depths of your heart and connect you to God. That is why the tradition of recitation is still extant today and has many followers.
There is a verse in the Holy Quran that says, "Verily, in the remembrance of God do hearts find rest." And the reading or reciting the divine verses of the Holy Book truly makes you remember your Creator and help you find peace.
The Endowment and Charity Affairs Organization, which organizes the Quranic event, says the motto of this year's edition is One Book, One Ummah. It says the ultimate goal of the event is to unite the Muslim community based on the teachings of the Holy Book of Quran.
Not all Muslims can recite the Holy Book of Quran as perfectly as contestants here do, but every Muslim family has the Holy Book in their houses to read it and ponder the messages embedded in its verses. Messages that Muslims here say boil down to this key instruction: follow the path of righteousness. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The Nigerian government has described the commencement of this vaccination exercise of Nigerians as a historic moment in the fight against the COVID-19. The kickoff of the vaccination followed the delivery of close to 4 million doses of the COVAX AstraZeneca vaccines to Nigeria on 2nd March 2021. Nigerian health officials said the delay in the start of the vaccination was to ensure that the vaccines were checked for safety.
The vaccines that we're going to be delivering today to Nigerians are safe, they're effective, and we're going to roll out this vaccine in a very efficient manner, just like we all work together as one country and defeated the white polio viruses. Today, it feels proud to be a Nigerian. All of you should be proud.
The Nigerian government said Nigerians should support the planned and systematic rollout of the vaccines and mobilize citizens for the vaccination exercise. The United Nations Children Fund, UNICEF, played an important role in the arrival of the vaccines and says the successful battle against the COVID-19 will impact positively on routine immunization of Nigerian children against the other preventable childhood killer diseases.
UNICEF was the organization that did the procurement and the delivery of those vaccines on the 2nd of March. And we're very, very pleased that today we're able to administer them. But also now the challenge is getting them to the states, and the states starting to vaccinate the frontline workers, the health workers, so that they can be protected as quickly as is possible.
This medical doctor becomes the first Nigerian at this occasion to be given the COVID-19 vaccination. He has been a frontline health worker since March 2020. And has lost his father to the COVID-19. 158,000 Nigerians have so far been infected with the COVID-19, and over 1,900 have died of the disease. The World Health Organization has stated
that the vaccines have undergone rigorous regulatory processes at global and country level and have been certified safe and effective. The next challenge for Nigerian health officials is how to reach millions of Nigerians in remote rural communities. Danjuma Abdullahi, Abuja.
Anti-monarchy activists showed up at the headquarters of Spain's car manufacturer SEAT in the north of Barcelona to protest a visit by King Felipe and Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez. Protesters shouted slogans against the monarch and held banners reading "Catalonia has no king," 1 week after violent riots shook the region over the imprisonment of a rapper for insulting Spanish royals.
The rejection of the Spanish monarchy has become a recurrent theme with every royal visit to Catalonia over the past years. Here are some of the grievances with regard to this particular visit to the car factory.
The King of Spain will never be welcome in Catalonia. The King of the October 3rd speech, the King who 3.5 years ago called business owners to urge them to relocate their headquarters out of Catalonia, is not welcome.
The Spanish government Thursday announced it will dedicate part of the Coronavirus European Recovery Fund to launch an electric car battery plant with SEAT's parent company, Volkswagen. But trade unions say the transition towards a greener economy requires transparent labor reforms and should not overlook basic rights.
We need to know how the European Recovery Fund is going to be spent. We believe it should be entirely put under public administration. The investments in the car industry should be in compliance with public interest first, and that includes taking into account the reduction of the average working hours in view of the increasing automation.
The automotive industry in Spain generates nearly 2 million direct and indirect jobs. It represents 10% of the GDP and 19% of total exports. Declining sales and extended shutdowns due to the coronavirus pandemic have forced Japanese car maker Nissan last year to shut down one of its 3 plants in Catalonia. Kasai Kadrik, Barcelona.
In his very first campaign speech to win the presidential election, Joe Biden promised to more than double the federal minimum wage from just over $7 an hour to a minimum of $15 per hour. However, the ruling Democratic Party has retracted the wage increase from the third fiscal stimulus negotiations, disappointing 30 million low-wage workers in the middle of a once-in-a-century economic crisis. There is a whopping 75% public approval rating for Biden's stimulus program, but those polls came out before many of the details were released. Biden has since pulled support for many of the economic promises he made during his election campaign. After just 1 month in office, Biden has so far backtracked on his promises for major student debt relief, the amount of and length of unemployment payments, the total amount of household stimulus checks, and he has made no mention of reversing Donald Trump's signature tax cuts for the rich, something that Biden promised to initiate on his very first day in office.
It really shows the bankruptcy of every 4 years, this incrementalism where the left in the United States is pressured into getting behind the Democratic candidate, not going third party. Why? Because, oh, well, we're going to get these small concessions, like something like, hey, a $15 minimum wage increase or student loan debt, things like that.
However, countless economists insist that a wage increase would stimulate the economy overall by giving workers more money to spend, thus creating jobs and badly needed growth.
By doing that, by saying that, you know, it's impacting small businesses, what they're effectively doing is taking the economic burden that's put on small businesses by corporations, which own and control the politicians in Washington, they're shifting that burden onto workers and making workers pay the price.
The so-called fight for $15 began shortly after 2009, which is the last year the federal minimum wage was increased. But a decade later, studies show that constant inflation means that $15 per hour in 2021 would not constitute a living wage for a single adult household in any state. The study said in the cheapest metropolitan areas, $20 per hour is now required while major cities would need $25 per hour. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
India claims violence has dropped significantly in Kashmir since New Delhi stripped the region of its special status in 2019. However, local politicians accuse the Indian government of silencing Kashmiri people by installing an atmosphere of fear. The question is, who is telling the truth? A lot has changed since India ended Kashmir's special status in August 2019. The region is now open to investors and non-locals who want to live there. Kashmir is also now open to workers from other parts of India. None of this was possible before New Delhi ended Kashmir's autonomy. India has been changing the laws applying to Kashmir on a wide scale since then, and these moves have gone largely unopposed. How has there not been any major agitation inside Kashmir? Political analysts believe the apparent silence does not mean the people of the region have consented to India's actions.
It is not silence, rather enforced silence, because of a situation of a sort of martial law or emergency, undeclared martial law or undeclared emergency that was imposed upon them in 2019. And since most of their leadership was put behind the jails, activists of all sorts were also detained. Therefore, a sort of muteness remained there.
Although the people of Kashmir are unhappy with New Delhi's recent decisions and policy changes, they fear that dissenting would have adverse repercussions.
When India decided to scrap Kashmir's special status, we were promised to be given more opportunities, jobs and accessibility. But soon after August 5, 2019, they did the total opposite of what they had promised. The worst thing is that we cannot even oppose it. And if we do so, we will end up in jail. What India has done is completely authoritarian and undemocratic.
However, despite a growing crackdown in the region, the recent ceasefire between India and Pakistan has brought a ray of hope.
Neither the silence is permanent, nor their postures, hard postures, are permanent. They are compelled because of international situations to dilute. I have often mentioned that Kashmir is a volcano which remains dormant for a while, but it erupts and surprises everyone. So the only solution to it is that the core issue and aspirations of people should be addressed so that people have a sense of achievement.
Kashmir has been a bone of contention between Islamabad and New Delhi ever since India broke from British rule in 1947. Pakistan and India each control a part of the region, but both claim it in full. Shahana Bhatt, Indian Administered Kashmir.
$1.7 billion was a pledge in the latest UN Doha conference for Yemen, which is less than half of what was targeted. The United Nations described the pledges as disappointing. Yemeni people say they don't want the UN to continue begging for aid, but rather they want the Saudi-led war to be ended and the blockade lifted.
We said that we do not need any humanitarian support. They only have to stop the war and lift the siege on Yemen. And the Yemenis, with their capabilities and resources, can obtain their basic needs. Yet this conference came to glorify the countries participating in the war on Yemen and present them as a country supporting humanitarian work.
Human rights activists say the UN seeks to fulfill its programs through such campaigns, since what reaches the people in need is much less than what it spends as operational expenses for its local organizations.
The donors' conference is an attempt to cover the UN failure in managing humanitarian aid that has caused an increase in the need as well as the money that is gained. It's not aimed at covering the real need in Yemen, but rather to ensure the continuity of the work of the UN organizations, where about 70% of these insufficient funds are spent as operational expenses for organizations' programs.
According to the United Nations, Yemenis are experiencing the world's worst humanitarian crisis since the beginning of 2015, when Saudi Arabia and its regional allies launched a devastating war on the impoverished country. Yemenis say the UN campaigns and initiatives are useless unless they are associated with real steps to stop the ongoing war and the blockade on Yemen that have led to the death of tens of thousands of civilians, including women and children, and is still going on. عبد اللطيف الوشلي صنع.
Iranian Radio Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
According to the ACLU of Louisiana, Louisiana has the highest rate of prison death per capita in the country. The state has more people serving life sentences without parole than Alabama, Arkansas, Mississippi, Tennessee, and Texas combined. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Francis Madison, writer. This article is published under the heading, Louisiana Hunger Strikers Already in Solitary Are Being Brutally Punished. Here's more. On February 13th, men being held in one of the solitary confinement wards at the Louisiana State Penitentiary in Angola were discussing how to get out from under their miserably austere physical conditions. These included broken lights in their cells, a single blanket, and inadequate heating in record cold temperatures of northern Louisiana. The men also experienced brutal psychological conditions, including no time outside in the yard at all, and only limited time out in the hall where they may or may not be lucky enough to make it into the shower in the 15 minutes allotted to them. They've been isolated, understimulated, living in semi-darkness. They were at the end of their emotional tether. They rejected the only available official route for individuals to resolve grievances within the Louisiana Department of Corrections, LADOC, the administrative remedy procedure, because they, while officially it can take up to 90 days for a determination, practically it often takes much longer. Some of the men had some success in the past in getting the prison administration's attention by refusing meals and gesturing toward a hunger strike, getting positive results, often on the same day. Officially, a strike is acknowledged as such when 9 consecutive meals are refused. By law, after the 9th refused meal, LADOC is compelled to notify the Louisiana Department of Public Safety and Corrections and must minister to the men with medical care and hear their grievances and demands. The men were aware that the LADOC solitary practices had been the subject of two major critical reports by the Vera Institute for Justice and the ACLU, both member organizations of the Louisiana Stop Solitary Coalition, and expected that their cries would not be ignored. Reaching consensus, they picked February 17th, one day after Mardi Gras, as their start date for a hunger strike, when prison officials would likely be back on the job after the holiday break. Since COVID began, she has been engaged in a regular correspondence with 15 different men incarcerated in Angola. When the strike was called, they reached out. Her friend, journalist John McDevitt, broke the story on Liberation, including her request for the public to contact the prison, a move that was echoed by the Stop Solitary Coalition in these press releases. Ross had been locked in solitary confinement since last April, and he expected to be transferred to a working cell block by November, which is the next step down on the way back to the general prison population. But he hasn't had his disciplinary hearing yet, which means that all these months of waiting in segregation will not be credited to his disciplinary sentence when it's handed down. It's what's referred to as dead time, another misery in his 50-year prison sentence. The hunger strike started on February 17th with 15 participants. 12 days later, there were four remaining strikers: Ross, Percy Hathaborn, Donald Hensley, and Tosmond Normand. They have held out against various offers from a colonel, a rank that is second in command under the warden, because they suspected he was not representing the administration and that his offers were a trick. The offers included promises of immediate transfer but out of segregation, as well as punishments, including threats of being maced in their cells. Witnesses report that at the beginning of the action, guards were playing cat and mouse with food trays, putting them on the floor in front of the cell, waiting 2 minutes, and whisking them away, but without documenting the strikers' refusal as required by LADOC policy. 12 days in, people close to the strikers reported that no unusual occurrence reports had been completed. Basic jail guidance 3007 requires written procedures for significant unusual occurrences or institutional emergencies, including but not limited to major disturbances such as riots, hostage situations, escapes, fires, death, serious illness or injury, and assaults or other acts of violence. Nor have the strikes been examined medically, which would follow as a consequence of filing the reports. In the physiology of hunger, at around the 2-week mark, the human body goes through some rapid changes that can make standing difficult. Strikers can also suffer from severe dizziness, sluggishness, weakness, loss of coordination, low heart rate, and chills. On the 5th day, strikers say they requested medical assessment, offering to pay for it themselves. It has not been forthcoming. The hunger strikers are also facing reprisals. Russ was moved to another section of the prison called Camp C on February 23rd. His loved ones told reporters that the cell he is now in has a leaking toilet and a constantly wet floor. He spends all day and night on the upper bunk, descending only when let out to shower. After being moved, he was not allowed to use the wall phone to make collect calls.
and his loved ones called the prison on February 28 to inquire why they hadn't been hearing from him. They were told that they had been written up for a violation and his phone privileges were suspended. When asked what violation, they were told it was participating in hunger strike. After complaints by family members and supporters, his phone access was restored. On February 27th, a report from a man who had come off the strike reached reporters. He said that security approached strikers' cells at 11:30 the previous night when they were sleeping and repeated an ominous request, "Come to the bars." Those who didn't act fast enough were sprayed down with mace, a form of collective punishment in an enclosed cell block. The strikers contend that LADOC is violating its own policies. In current practice, when people are removed from the general population for infractions, they were placed first in administrative segregation and after the disciplinary hearing. In disciplinary segregation, which is exactly the same thing in terms of conditions and punishments, the length of their punishment is dictated by the agency's internal disciplinary sanctions matrix, a document shrouded in secrecy and unavailable to the public, including journalists and prison advocates. In his piece in The Lens, journalist Nicolas Trasti reported that while the number of strikers was under dispute by LADOC, the agency did not deny the validity of the strikers' fundamental grievance. But also, Trasti noted the Department of Corrections declined to provide a copy of its disciplinary policy to The Lens. Kiana Calloway is an organizer with Voice of the Experience, a grassroots organization in New Orleans, founded by formerly incarcerated people working against the prison industrial complex and toward a future of mass liberation for all. Calloway says that even the advocates who were asked by LADOC for input in rewriting the disciplinary policy have been working with limited information. "We have a meeting with LADOC right before COVID," Calloway told reporters. "We were in the process of actually helping them rewrite that matrix, but we never got to see the matrix they had already in position." After learning of the hunger strike, Crystal Imbargo wrote to the Louisiana Stop Solitary Coalition asking for help in publicizing her husband's plight in Angola, despite the possibility of retaliation. Imbargo's husband has been confined in solitary for more than 7 years. And with additional punishments being heaped on him, it's more than they can bear, as she wrote in an email sent to the coalition on February 25th.
The debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashmi. The Saudi onslaught on the Yemeni people is fast approaching its sixth year in what Riyadh thought would be a month's bliss. And victory over the poor country of Yemen has turned into an embarrassment for the Saudis and their allies. The Saudi regime, which has been armed to the teeth by their Western allies in Washington, London, and Paris, are now facing defeat on Sunday. A Saudi reconnaissance plane was shot down by a Yemeni missile. Abdul Latif Al-Washali says the plane that was down by the Yemeni military was very sophisticated. He says this shows that the army has boosted its air defense capabilities in the face of Saudi attacks. Let's listen.
The Yemeni army's air defenses had successfully shot down a combat turbulence belonging to the Saudi-led coalition, to the Saudi forces actually. It's Turkish-made. It was above the Al-Mazariq directorate in Al-Jawf governorate, carrying out aggressive missions against the Yemeni people. It's not the first time that the Yemeni army targets this kind of a drone successfully. It's been many times. This drone is very sophisticated, so this is an indicate of the Yemeni army's improved capabilities regarding air defense. The Saudi coalition had launched several airstrikes today in Sana'a, so this comes as a response to these hostile acts by the Saudi-led coalition.
I'd like to welcome my first guest to the program. Let's start it off in Sana'a. Welcome, Mr. Hossein Abdelkhati, activist and political commentator. Thank you so much for being with us. Well, let's start off with what has happened currently. Let's talk about the progress that the Yemeni army has made and what you attribute it to. Okay. Unfortunately, we cannot hear Hossein Abdelkhati. Let me see if we can cross over to Washington, D.C., and if we have our second guest, Michael Springman, author and former U.S. diplomat. Can you hear me, Michael Springman?
Yes, I can hear you through the phone here in the studio.
Okay, great. Yeah, unfortunately, we're having a little bit of technical difficulties tonight. We're working out of another studio. I appreciate everyone's patience. Well, Michael, let's look at what is happening when we look at the situation that has taken place. I mean, about to enter the sixth year of something that was probably, with Riyadh's calculation, that was supposed to take a month or two. What do you attribute this to? Let's start from there.
Well, I attribute to the 6 years of war to the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, who began it, Mohammed bin Salman, not being able to see the handwriting on the wall, along with the United Arab Emirates. They have been trying to destroy Yemen for the past 6 years, and the Ansar Allah people, the freedom fighters, have been resisting, have been increasing their territory, holding a good 60% of the population, and of course that population supports them. The Al-Qaeda, Daesh, ISIS, whatever you want to call it, the people sponsored by the United States and Saudi Arabia are holding, according to a Yemeni journalist I talked to this morning, Nasser Shakir, they're holding the Marib province, which is mostly mountainous and sparsely populated, and they're still fighting, and of course, what's sparking all this, or continuing it, is America, Britain, France, Germany selling the Saudis and Emiratis weapons. Now, Biden claims that he's going to stop selling offensive weapons to the Saudis, but I frankly don't see any difference between an offensive and defensive weapon. Whether it's a rifle with bullets, a tank, or a fighter aircraft, you can use it to defend your country, or you can use it to attack another country. The Americans have not renounced their war in Yemen. They've killed some 1,000 Yemenis with repeated American strikes inside the country. And for Biden to preach that he's dropping all sanctions and at the same time sanctioning high officials of the Ansar Allah movement because they attack ships presumably belonging to the Saudis is frankly hypocrisy. So it's basically the Americans, as always, are talking out of both sides of their mouth and hoping to profit from the destruction caused.
Okay. Stay with me, Michael. Hopefully we can cross over to Sana'a and talk to Hossein Abdelkhati now, activist and political commentator. Hossein, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay. I'm not sure I will be able to hear you. We're going to try this one time. Hossein, just give me your evaluation of what is taking place, especially events that we've seen today. What do you attribute this to? We have seen, especially today, and of course, shooting down a reconnaissance plane with a missile How did we get here? It seems like things have definitely reversed from where it started almost 6 years ago.
Yes, this is exactly what's happening now. Yemeni armed forces have shot down today a Turkish-made drone over Marib. This is the second Turkish-made drone to be shot down by Yemeni army. And today there was a statement from Yemeni armed forces spokesperson Amid Yahya Sari', which has announced a large-scale military operation inside Saudi Arabia. This include an attack using 14 drones and 8 ballistic missiles. There was the focus of this operation was Ras Tanura port in the Persian Gulf. This is one of the largest oil port in the world, and it exports 85% to 90% of Saudi oil production. Another drones and 7 ballistic missiles has targeted areas and military site inside Najran and Jizan and Asir. And to be honest with you, that now Saudi Arabia actually is becoming more and more under attack from Yemen. They have conducted today attack against sites inside Sana'a, including a fuel storage. This show you that Saudi actually deliberately blocking fuel ship from coming into Yemen, and as well deliberately targeting fuel storage in Sana'a today, because they want to bring the Yemeni people to their knees. But I think what's happening now is the opposite, especially after the latest announcement of this large-scale military operation. I believe if Yemeni army will extend its attack against all Saudi oil infrastructure, then we can actually end this war by breaking Saudi Arabia. But if we keep actually offering Saudi peace and offering Saudi truth, Saudi will continue in their blockade. And hundreds of hospitals are running low in fuel. Many businesses has closed. And yesterday, the Ministry of Health has announced that they are running low of fuel and some hospitals might close. That's why I think Yemeni army should send a direct message to Saudi Arabia and to the United States that they will continue to target Saudi Arabia, target especially their oil infrastructure, if this war will not end and if this blockade will not be lifted from Yemen.
All right, stay with me, Hossein. Michael, your take on this, as I was saying earlier, definitely the tables have turned, and 6 years later, the Saudis and their allies are in a very, let's say, awkward position, to say the least. Why, prior to this time, and we're talking about 6 years, why has it taken so long, and why didn't the Saudis, prior to this point in time, basically just accept defeat and cut their losses?
Well, like all governments, when they're in an unpopular situation, they realize that if they quit and pull out and don't have a realistic cover story to explain this, they look bad, they seem to be aggressors, they appear to their own population as vacillating and dangerous to their neighbors. So I think that they prefer to keep digging at the hole they've dug themselves into, and it's getting to the point now where it's getting so deep they can't climb out of it. They realize what's happening. They can't be that stupid. But they figure as long as they keep fighting in Yemen, and Yemen, of course, is about the poorest Arab country, if not the poorest country in the entire world. 24 million of 29 million people in the country are short of food. More than 200,000 people, and a good bit of them women and children, have been killed either directly as a result of the fighting or because of lack of food, lack of potable water, and lack of decent health care services.
So Michael,
so
let me just jump in.
As long as it's
Michael.
Yemen that they're attacking, and they're not attacking Iran, they're not attacking France or Germany or any other country that can fight back and has a strong economic base. The economy in Yemen is just shot to hell. It doesn't exist anymore, from what I can see and have been told. So they figure we'll keep going after Yemen because Yemen can't fight back, and world public opinion doesn't care about Yemen.
Well, Hossein, let me get you back in this conversation. I mean, you talked about basically now that the Yemenis, the military, is not going to give in and will continue to put the pressure on Saudi Arabia now until the victory. Let's talk about the Yemeni people. Of course, the Yemeni people have suffered a lot and has been under a lot of pressure, as Michael has just talked about, from not only just bombardment, but also blockade. Now, with that being said, I want your overall opinion as far as the analysis on the ground, the Yemeni people and wanting to go forward until the victory. How did they get here? How were they able to sustain themselves throughout this, and not only sustain themselves, but actually even make, we've seen a lot of technical advances.
To be honest with you, I think that this war actually has exposed who are willing to offer help to Saudi Arabia and who are loyal to United States, and those that people are actually fighting side by side with the Saudi backed forces. And if we can see, as an example, latest attack against Marib to liberate Marib, we've seen this huge outcry from the outside international community. And the reason for that Marib actually has become the last Al-Qaeda and ISIS safe haven in north of Yemen. Here, Sana'a forces have cleared all areas under Sana'a control, but this last area is Marib, north of Yemen. And we've seen that Marib actually produced 85 to 95 of oil and gas production. And this was actually 90% of Yemeni budget come from that oil and gas. And we've seen that no single rial actually is putting back into central bank in Sana'a, neither in Aden to pay the salaries and wages of Yemeni. United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia and other countries involved in this war, they keep stealing the oil and gas and selling for their advantage, and Yemeni actually are suffering hugely, especially the blockade. Since Biden took place, Saudi did not allow a single ship to enter Hodeidah port. This means that even though Biden said he will stop supporting Saudi Arabia, but actually they are enforcing more blockade on Yemen. Neither Trump has not blocked this amount of oil tanker from reaching Hodeidah, but Biden, in just a matter of 3 weeks, they haven't let any ship to enter Yemen. That's why actually Yemeni now had come to a conclusion. They must unite themselves. They must liberate Marib, liberated from Al-Qaeda and ISIS and other Saudi-backed forces. They must gain back our oil field and gas production. They should come back to Sana'a, and they're going to pay the salaries, because Yemen actually cannot lift this blockade at this time by force, because maybe they have not the ability to attack in the sea, or to lift this blockade. That's why they have gone towards Marib, and that's why today they have actually directly hit the heart of the Saudi oil production.
Okay. Well, Michael, what is it about Yemen that these Western allies of Saudi Arabia won't give up? What are they after? Why will they not put pressure, and they have not put pressure, on Saudi Arabia to stop this war? Not only did they not put pressure, but they support what the Saudis have been doing. Why is that the case?
Well, it's the case because they see the oil that sits under the sands of Saudi Arabia is something like 17% of the world's reserves. They see the huge sales of weapons that these Western countries make to Saudi Arabia and to the United Arab Emirates, two of the most repressive and repulsive and medieval monarchies in the world. They don't want to go against the Western news media, which apparently is completely under control of the warmongering tribes, whether American, Israeli, or Saudi. I did some searches today on Google and could find nothing negative about the American support of the war or the European support of the war. And when you look more closely at it on DuckDuckGo, for example, you find that articles that don't talk about Iran using Yemen as a cat's paw to destabilize the Arabian Peninsula. You don't see articles about Yemen controlling being controlled by Iran. You don't see articles about Iran trying to destroy Saudi Arabia by use of Yemen. by supplying them with missiles, by supplying them with drones, by supplying them with this, that, and the other thing that enables them to resist the Saudi and Emirati attacks on their country. And it's the people, of course, in the West won't cry out about this. They will go on and on and on about Black Lives Matter here in the United States, but don't think Brown Lives Matter in Yemen, because they don't care. All they get is the one-sided whitewash view of the wonderful allies of Saudi Arabia and the Gulf Cooperation Council, particularly the Emirates. The Americans and the Europeans are so enamored of their own press and their own media that never ask questions, that never puts the Saudis and the Emiratis on the spot, that never puts restrictions on the travel of their officials or their citizens to other parts of the world. And this is exactly why the West supports them. They think it looks good in the eyes of the world news media that they're supporting this horrible country, Yemen, that is really a cat's paw and alter ego, if you will, of Iran. And, of course, okay. Iran is the source of all evil in the entire world, according to these people.
Well, Hussein, you had said that it's going to continue now. You believe the Yemeni army is going to continue until victory. What do you think that entails? I mean, do you feel that the Yemeni military is on the edge of victory, or your assessment of the current situation?
I think we are here in Yemeni army are on the verge of victory, because we've seen now they are advancing on the ground. They have the upper hand on the ground, and as well, Saudi is not anymore safe. And if they continue those types of attack, I believe that Yemeni army will be that Yemeni army can actually defeat Saudi Arabia. And but if only those attack will keep hitting Saudi infrastructure and Saudi oil infrastructure, I believe that this war could come to an end soon. That's why Saudi Arabia have seen in this latest attack they could not actually to change anything. They have hit many areas in Sana'a. They have used all the power they have on their hand. They have got all the support from the United States and UK and other country. But at this time, Yemeni army still have a huge and large targets inside Saudi Arabia. Okay. That's why I believe attack like that, and attack against Saudi oil infrastructure, and as well attack against Saudi ports and airports. Even though some airports might be civilian airports, but we have came to as they say, an eye for an eye. And Saudi actually has forced Yemeni to do so. And we have seen latest announcement about a week ago in Saudi.
Okay.
Said they
I'm have, so sorry. I'm going to have to interrupt you,
targeted
Hussein.
By 600 drones, as they say, and 300 ballistic
okay.
missiles.
Hussein, I'm sorry. I'm going to have to interrupt you. We're out of time. I think that he probably cannot hear me, but I want to thank him for being with us. Hussein al-Bahati, activist and political commentator out of Sana'a. Michael Springman, author and former U.S. diplomat out of Washington, D.C. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another